This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Over the past quarter century, Jonah Goldberg has made his name as one of the most provocative and unapologetic conservative journalists around. He was the editor of National Review Online for years before leaving over differences related to Donald Trump, and he's penned best-selling books such as Liberal Fascism and Suicide of the West. He was a Fox News contributor for years, resigning in 2021 in protest of that channel's airing of Tucker Carlson's documentary, Patriot Purge. Along with former Weekly Standard editor Steve Hayes, who also resigned from Fox over the Carlson documentary, he founded The Dispatch in 2019, and he hosts the popular podcast The Remnant. At a recent event in New York City, I talked with Goldberg about the fracturing of the political right into groups ranging from national conservatives to theocons to post-liberal integralists to never-Trumpers to anti-Trumpers and more. We also discussed the 2024 election and whether libertarians and conservatives can ever really get along. Here is The Reason Interview with Jonah Goldberg. Okay, well, let's get started. You know, part of this Salon series, and we should say thank you to our host, John Farber, who is somewhere out there. Thank you, John, for hosting this and putting it together. But, you know, we want to talk to interesting people who are, you know, defenders of kind of free speech and free thought, but more than anything, honest argumentation, good faith argumentation. So, you know, that's kind of a backdrop. Let's start by talking about the modern conservative movement. You have been, pretty acid lately in your denunciations or critiques of national conservatives, of integralists. Is that?
Integralists.
Okay. Let's start with Patrick Deneen, who is one of the integralists. Who is he, and what is wrong with his vision of a kind of theocratic conservatism?
Sure. So first of all, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. You know, if you know him from the bathroom, you may know me from such films as Zinc and You, Partners in Freedom. But it's a deep Simpsons cut, yes. People. If you want to go deeper, I could take this thing and just start singing a few chords of High Anxiety.
We don't have the coffee table for that.
First of all, just on the nomenclature stuff. Mm. There's a bunch of different factions of what is now being called the new right, right? And one of the frustrations I have is that by my count, since World War II, this is like the fifth new right. So it's, you know, this whole idea of the new right, which comes basically every 10 to 15 years, suggests that it's often really a phase, right? But anyway, so there are different aspects of the new right. One is the NatCons, you know, the self-described nationalists. Another are the post-liberal integralists. Mm-hmm. They used to get along great. They used to go to each other's conferences. Now they hate each other. And then there are other sort of sub-flavors, you know, people's front of Judea and Judea's people front kind of things. And then to the right of them, and I use right advisedly, are the cranks, peckerwoods, racists, neo-Nazis, groypers, alt-right, you know, all those guys. Who sometimes cross-pollinate around, right? But I don't think it's fair to say that Deneen is associated with those guys, even though there are some mutual admiration cross-currents every now and then. So Patrick Deneen is a Catholic political theorist. He's a political theorist who is a sincere Catholic. He teaches at...
He's at Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. Yep. And
he elevated from Georgetown, the second best-known Catholic university, to the best, right? To the biggest.
I assume that's right, yeah. And I mean, they got the touchdown Jesus, which, you know, really sort of settles that argument. And Patrick, I know him a little bit personally, got along fine with him. He wrote a big book that made a lot of attention, in part because Barack Obama stupidly plugged it, called Why Liberalism Failed. And the basic argument there, which I thought was deeply flawed, but well presented, right? There was a coherence to it. I thought there was significant intellectual dishonesty insofar as sort of just skipping inconvenient arguments. I mean, I think there's like one to be sure sentence about, yeah, things are better for women since the 1600s, mm-hmm. but there's this other kind of bondage.
But they
they're
won't
in now.
Shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
To be sure.
Right. They just won't listen. And but it was a better book, deeply flawed. Basic argument was John Locke conjured through word magic the Enlightenment. Enlightenment's really bad, and we should get rid of it. But he didn't exactly say how. And the best thing about why liberalism failed is that he sort of took a position that you and I have taken for a very long time, which is that it was subsidiarity, federalism. He was like, I don't know what's going to replace this stuff, but I do know it's going to have to be a lot of different approaches, a lot of different systems and all that kind of thing. And he read the Riot Act by a guy named Adrian Vermeule, who is another of these post-liberal integralist guys who wants the United States to basically be a confessional state allied to the Pope in Rome. And
I love that, the Pope in Rome. You know, it's not like the 1500s. There aren't two popes or anything, right? So we're like,
one could show up in Avignon.
It's like
saying
Bozo
any
the
minute.
Clown. It's right? Just, no, it's the Pope.
Okay.
Right?
Well, but it had some drama, right. You know. So, so Deneen said, you're right, I'm wrong. And he embraced what he calls, he said that we may have to embrace Schmittian and Machiavellian tactics.
Explain who Schmitt is.
Carl Schmitt was a German philosopher. He was a bad man. Like, people throw around terms like Nazi at people who don't deserve it all the time. He deserved it. He was considered the crown jurist of the Third Reich. His fundamental philosophy was that politics is about friends and enemies, and you punish your enemies and you reward your friends. He had this famous line where he says, tell me who your enemy is and I will tell you who you are. Very dark, very Machiavellian.
And he theorized that liberal states, you know, are particularly prone to being kind of undone in states of emergency. They have to conjure states of emergency to deal with real things, and then they are easily kind of taken over. And he was basing that on Weimar Germany turning into the Nazi state through kind of semi-democratic means.
Right. The whole idea was that democracy and liberalism were sort of like mold on the cheese, and you could scrape it off and get back to the real fundament of human nature, which is authoritarianism and tribalism and all of these kinds of things. And so he basically said, I reject now my federalist, my subsidiarity, my localism. We need one size fits all confessional state imposed from top down. And he turned those thoughts into this latest book called Regime Change, which is really kind of a hot mess. And what he basically tries to do is put flesh on the bones of what this after liberalism, what argument would be. And as a conservative, you know, there's stuff in there I'm sympathetic to. There are arguments in there or complaints there that I think have merit. But you draw back and you look at it in terms of his political theory and also just the political analysis. I mean, it kind of fails more. Like, I was planning on bringing a lot of like political theory skills mm-hmm. to reading it. And instead, it's like the punditry is where it just comes apart. Like,
what's an example of that?
Like, he just asserts with no evidence. You know, like, I mean, it's so obvious that Ezra Klein pointed it out that
also a deep cut.
There's no. He doesn't present any evidence that the vast sum of non-elite Americans, the big homogeneous blob of the many, are socially conservative, economically progressive people. He just asserts it. And he reduces vast swaths of America to thinking that everyone from African Americans in New York to bikers for Trump, all they need are the right elites and they will sign up completely for a socially conservative, let's ban porn, let's bring back Sabbath laws, let's do all of that stuff, because that's who they are. And that's the sort of problem I have with so much of this stuff, is that so much of it is just LARPing, right? It is these people who think that because they could fill, like, this is a wonderful room, lovely people. I do not extrapolate that for every one of you here, there are 500,000 more just like you, right, who all love reason. But the sort of post-liberal guys, the nationalist guys, they fill a room, they get 5,000 retweets, and they think, aha, we have the people on our side. And it's all such hothouse kind of fantasy stuff that just falls apart when you actually try to extrapolate what they're actually arguing at scale. The idea that there are hundreds of millions of ultramontane Catholics who want to sign up for a non-liberal confessional state is just, it's, you might as well be arguing about whether Superman could beat the Hulk.
Right. Of course he couldn't. So how does, unless I guess it, he's got kryptonite, right? And then it depends on what, let's not go there.
This is a rabbit hole I can go down.
Yeah, no, I would rather not. but how are the integralists different or distinct from the national conservatives?
Sure, this is easier and I promise to go shorter. So the NatCons, to the extent they have leadership, it's this guy, Yoram Hazony. The place where the Venn diagrams overlapped and where they found common cause was this, again, this idea that virtually all of liberalism springs out of the mind of John Locke, like out of the brow of Zeus, and that all you have to do to end the magical ensorcelment of the West is convince people that John Locke is bad or wrong, and then all of a sudden everybody will just like, oh, the spell is broken. I actually want to live as a serf, right, or whatever it is, right? And so Hazony kind of believed this stuff. The Dedean crowd believe this stuff about Locke. They have similar arguments, which I think, which we can talk about, completely ignore the fact that America has an actual thing called a culture. You know, we're a liberal people. Whatever our partisan affiliations are, we believe in freedom. We have our head and our heart wired together for some full tilt boogie for freedom and justice. And the NatCons have broken with the integralists in part because they are much more of, they just like the idea of federal power, federal assertion. My basic take on Hazony is that he has decided to take the entire warp and woof of Western civilization going back some 4,000 years and bend everybody from Aristotle to John Locke into the argument about why Israel should have uncontested right to do whatever it wants in the occupied territories.
That America, exists to help that.
Yeah, he imposes the nationalist vision about how EU bad, EUs are empires, that nationalism is never wrong. The second nationalism is wrong. He says that's imperialism. That's not what I'm arguing for. It's a very convenient argument. And those guys, where they also all overlap, is on things like industrial policy and that kind of stuff. But like a faculty lounge, the knives are so big because the stakes are so small, they now hate each other on all sorts of levels and won't go to each other.
How does this fit in with common good conservatism, which I guess Marco Rubio is a spokesman for now? Is that distinct from this or?
It's downstream. It's sort of the It's the Disney version of a lot of this stuff, right?
Not the grooming Disney version.
No, not the grooming guy.
Yeah, okay.
It's like I always used to have this joke about how Bernie Sanders was like a tour guide at Epcot Center, and like, you know, and here we are. Here's the Sweden exhibit. They have all the free healthcare, right? It's like this complete Potemkin village caricature of the reality of what Scandinavia is like. That's a lot of what these guys are doing. They're playing games with these ideas. And they've convinced I think the thing that's going on with people like Rubio and Holly and Vance and these guys, it's less a sincere political theoretical framework and more that they've gotten high on their farts over this idea that the GOP will be a new working class, transracial working class workers' party, right? And I'm one of the last names Goldberg. Whenever I hear workers' party, I get a little nervous. And they think that they can bottle the magic of populism with policy proposals. And I disagree with almost all of them. Some of them, but they're not crazy or they're just wrong, right? I mean, like they're wrong the way, like if a Democrat, like, I mean, they're basically signing up to a lot of stuff that Sherrod Brown and Elizabeth Warren have believed for a very long time.
How does Trump, you know, the emergence of Trump and Trump actually winning the presidency in 2016, that seems to have been a real kind of fracture point for the contemporary right. I think it's had an effect on libertarianism, which is a little bit different. But how does Trump, you know, factor into this?
Yeah. So, I mean, my own personal theory, I mean, I've said throughout all these years, is that people who want to make Trumpism into an ideological construct have already lost because it's a psychological phenomenon, both in terms of how he approaches things, but also how people approach him. And the idea that you're going to hold Trump to a coherent, consistent theoretical line of inquiry or thought or philosophy, it's just, you know, you might as well have a debate about stranded costs with a tic-tac-toe chicken in Chinatown. I mean, it's just, it's no point to it, right? Take whatever position he needs to in the moment. The thing I think that, broadly speaking, that Trump has done to the big chunks of the American right is the sort of Stakovite, the Russian, the Soviet phrase for hardworking, Stakovite. The effort it took to rationalize all of the support that people on the right felt, a lot of people on the right felt they had to do with Trump, required basically just pulling out the support beams for big chunks of the conservative project. Right? You had to say, well, you know, this thing that, you know, I used to think was one of the unifying things for conservatives, which was the idea that character matters, right? You know, whatever definition of character, just the idea of character matters. We can have an argument about what good character is. I don't think there's one, there's a definition of good character Trump can clear. I mean that quite sincerely. I've basically bet people for like 7 years to make me make, you know, make an argument. But when you start saying that doesn't matter at all, right? So everything that he ever said about Bill Clinton, that's got to go out the window now, right? The arguments about foreign policy, basically all out the window. The arguments about, you know, not necessarily abortion, but about constitutionalism, about trade, picking winners and losers. Remember, that was like a big thing.
Yeah.
Like 5 minutes before Trump went down the escalator, Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, he was like at this point in the 2016 cycle, he was the front runner and he was the whole, you know, crony capitalism is bad, tea parties are right kind of stuff. All the tea party stuff had to go out the window.
Yeah.
And so you do that, and all of a sudden, the sort of, and the way that the gatekeepers, the historic gatekeepers, like National Review, I was a big part of the push to do the against Trump issue, which people call the never Trump issue, but that term hadn't existed yet. The vilification the National Review went through. I mean, I remember hosts, you know, like news hosts on Fox saying, who does National Review think it is to tell voters how to vote? And I was like, I think it thinks it's National Review. I mean, like literally that's what National Review has done since 1955, is like endorse candidates, not endorse candidates. Although, you know,
famously did not endorse a presidential candidate in 1960.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what, you know, what happened, because you're no longer at National Review, did the Trumpists win in that quadrant of the right?
No.
What does that mean? I
don't think, my point is that, right, so the sort of the old carefully balanced cathedral, or for want of a better term, of what modern conservatism was, say in 2015, for all its flaws, I'm not saying it was perfect, so many people had to take sledgehammers to different aspects of it and in different ways that, or set fire to it, that for a lot of people, like Deneen, who mocks people for being never Trumpers for the first like 200 pages of the book, and then coughs that, yeah, Trump's a narcissist and a jerk at the very end when he knows what he's reading. There are a lot of these people who don't really care about Trump. You know, I don't think Sohrab Ahmari, who's another one of these guys, cares much about Trump.
Where is he? Is he a NatCon or is he an integralist?
He's an integralist for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And they were instrumental in their approach to Trump, and now it is just it's what does Littlefinger say in Game of Thrones? Chaos is a ladder. A lot of these people who would have had to have climbed the greasy pole of normal conservative stuff, normal conservative institutions, can now do these end runs and start these new things and claim to be the real voice of the people, and they get credentialized by Fox and OAN and Newsmax. And so the ability to do gatekeeping of any kind on the right has been shattered for a generation. And you just have a lot of sort of barbarian tribes coming in trying to set up shop.
Does the Dispatch count as a tribe or as a barbarian tribe?
All right, so my own podcast.
Because the Dispatch, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you're a publication that was founded from people like you from National Review, and then people from the Weekly Standard, who, you know, there was a difference between you guys. So, you know, is that part of a disintegration of whatever it was that held the right together?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. I mean, I brought up my podcast. It's called The Remnant for a reason. It's a throat. It's a deep cut to Albert J. Nock, who is like, if you do the Begats, of the conservatives and the libertarians, and you go back far enough, they kind of go through the Knox hut. And the remnant is basically this idea of the people, that irreducible sum of people who kind of know right from wrong, can smell the bullshit. They may disagree on all sorts of things, but they're just not going to be into it, right? And that's sort of my approach to the remnant. Mm. And it's sort of our approach to the Dispatch. We have a weirdly, I'd say the majority of our readers are center-right. Certainly, almost the entirety of the staff is center-right. But we've completely given up on the idea of like carrying water for the GOP. Mm. I personally can't. There are Republican politicians I like and respect, and there are lots more that I think are utter clowns. But I've lost entirely the whatever amount of sort of partisan knee-jerkery where I was like, well, the Republicans are my team.
Yeah.
I've lost.
Is that liberating?
It's great. I mean, yeah. I keep saying I've never been – I mean, I don't love all the friendships I lost, but right. like I've never been more politically – homeless but ideologically grounded, because no. I don't feel like there's any such thing of an enforceable heresy anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I come by, I mean, I like to think I always came by my positions honestly. I just don't worry about what the honesty is going to cost me anymore, because mm-hmm. whatever's going to cost me, it's already cost me.
Yeah. Do you think that the breakup of the right, and, you know, this could include libertarians or not, depending on how you play it, but how much of it, you know, there's the fact of Trump and Trump just being, you know, a weird force of nature who chose the Republican Party and kind of succeeded through that. But going back to the Bush years, George W. Bush, you know, he also contravened basic conservative principles. His foreign policy may have fallen in line with a kind of neoconservative interventionism, but it didn't work out very well.
Nope.
The way that it was paid for, the wars were paid for, at least in the first few years, it was dissembling. It was through special budget tricks and stuff mm-hmm. to keep things. The discussion about torture and all of that was also, you know, kind of fake. But then on the domestic side, you know, he pushed through massive government expansions of spending. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when Obama came along, the response was not very powerful either in terms of, you know, running people like Mitt Romney and then ultimately Trump. How much is it that in the 21st century, the broad-based right just, you know, its ideas were in power and it just, they didn't work or they didn't stay true to what they claimed to be their governing ideals?
Look, I think that narrative has enormous merit. I don't really substantively disagree with any of it. I criticized compassionate conservatism. I criticized Trump's expansion of government a lot. I always saw it as the Republican version of Clinton, feel your pain, Clintonism, rather than the Republican alternative to it. That
Which
said,
is what, I'll inflict your pain?
Or maybe. You know, like, no. I'm an Old Testament guy. I like my conservatism with more smiting and wrath. But So I'm perfectly fine talking about that narrative and all the rest, and I don't mean to cast shade on it by calling it a narrative, but yeah. What it leaves out is the utter irresponsibility of the critics of the Republican establishment, mm-hmm. right? So you had, you know, the line you always heard from, you know, the Ted Cruz's or Rush Limbaugh's and all of these guys was Paul Ryan and the Bushies and those guys, they overpromised and underdelivered. Absolutely true. Can't defend them on that, right? I was on a stage once, you know, with Paul Ryan saying, if we just win this election, we can repeal Obamacare, right? You know, like, and they'd win the election, they didn't repeal Obamacare. That's a perfectly fine criticism. But you also had people like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and Rush Limbaugh saying that you could get rid of Obamacare in 2013 with 40 votes in the Senate. You cannot get rid of Obamacare with just 40 votes in the Senate. There's this like majority thing that they do in the Senate. And time again, Hannity and these guys reduced, I mean, you want to talk about Schmidt, you know, like reduced political failure to an argument about a lack of will rather than an ability to persuade. You had Jim DeMint, who went to the Heritage Foundation. He was the guy who said he would rather have 30 real conservatives than a majority of 60 moderates, which is the kind of weird illogic that should have like Mitch McConnell's head exploding like one of the androids in the Harvey Mudd Star Trek. I mean, it's just like, you can't do anything with 30 senators. But with 60 senators, you can actually move the ball in a direction that's better than the alternative. And this idea, which I think now has mutated in the era of Trump, to this almost nihilistic, I mean, I think the correct term from Freud is really fucked up. Understand that, like, to win, to actually have a success, is proof that you sold out, mm-hmm. right? You look at this deal that McCarthy and Biden did on the debt ceiling thing. The whole spectacle was a pinata. You can bash it from any angle and it'll bear some reward. Yeah, there are all sorts of criticisms you can make. That's fine. But they made a deal. And the Freedom Caucus guys were like, shit, that looks bad for us because that means Biden got a win out of this. Better to fail on principle, you know, better to be a loser on principle than to compromise on anything. And this is, I think, why the argument that Trump will lose fails with so many Republicans is they kind of want to lose. They like the idea that they went, it's better to fight and die than to like work the system and get a partial win.
Wow. Where do you think that is coming from psychologically? And is that part of the remnant mentality, I guess, or let me phrase it more affirmatively. When you look at people like Albert J. Nock, who had a kind of terrible end to his life, both ideologically and also kind of publicly, but you know, there was a lot of people at the end of, say, of the old right at the end of the New Deal where they realized, okay, you know what, we've lost a lot.
Right.
And they didn't want to win. I mean, is that what we're going through here? Is it just people who, you know, kind of fetishize defeat because that's a sign of purity?
Yeah, so that's not what I mean by the remnant, right?
Okay. You know, yeah, no, I'm not saying you are, but I'm saying that these people
I think absolutely. I think there are these, you know, there's this whole, I mean, there's just the Leroy Jenkinsism run amok in the Republican Party is just really kind of astounding, right? And this, you know, and it was so, it's interesting. Mick Mulvaney, we interviewed him for at the Dispatch a couple of years
ago. This is like reading the passenger list on the Titanic. I mean, these people are like only a few years out of power, but it's
so like, Mick Mulvaney tells this story, which is kind of amazing, which is that he says at the beginning of Trump's presidency, Trump was really afraid of the House Freedom Caucus guys because the House Freedom Caucus guys, at least according to their press releases, are like really principled and conservative, and Trump isn't. So like he was like, these guys are going to give me a really hard time. And Mulvaney said, no, they're going to be your biggest supporters. And Trump's like, what do you mean? How could it be? And he says, because at the end of the day, the thing the House Freedom Caucus cares about the most is being anti-establishment, of turning over the tables. And the way Mulvaney, I don't think really appreciated what he was admitting to. He's one of the founders of the House Freedom Caucus.
And then went into the Trump administration.
And then went into the Trump administration and then condemned Trump afterwards and, you know, whatever. He's on a journey. But the House Freedom Caucus guys would talk in existential terms about debt and deficits under Obama as if they actually believed what they were saying. And they're doing it again now under Biden. They did not do it under Trump. Because, and so it sort of reveals is that it's much more performative, much more like we are going to grab good principled arguments and use them as weapons against the people we don't like, but we will drop our weapons and get in line behind the people that we do like. It's that approach to politics that I have uncontainable contempt for it.
Yeah. So how does that prepare you for 2024? What other than, you know, kind of an, you know, sitcom level laughs, what are you looking to get out of 2024?
Alive. Look, I don't know. I just find it amazing that, you know, everyone wants to talk about the replay of 2016 in terms of the giant primary field and all that. And yeah, that looks like it's happening. But I think if you take a step further back, you know, a big part of my theory about why American politics sucks is that the parties are too weak, not that they're too strong. That weak parties create strong partisanship because the parties are supposed to do the hard work of politics so that it doesn't spill out like toxic waste into the rest of the country. That's what Congress is supposed to do. It's supposed to soak up politics. So that stuff, that shit happens there. It's contained and it doesn't infiltrate every part of life. And the idea that this country is going to, again, repeat what it did in 2016, which is nominate the two most unpopular candidates possible that are so unpopular, they actually have a chance to lose to the other one. Is just so it's such not a way to run a railroad, right? And you know, everyone's talking about how old Biden is, and he's old and he's showing it, you know. And I make this joke all the time, you know, you have to give him a little bit of credit because he says weird stuff now, but he's always said weird stuff. If you go back through the archives, there's always been a non-trivial chance he's going to start shouting, "Get these squirrels off of me," right? I mean, he's just a weird dude. But so is Donald Trump, and he's 75, 76, whatever it is, you know. And but he's got, you know, hair like Stalin on chemo. But anyway, so you got this situation where both parties are presenting candidates that nobody in this country really, really wants to vote for. I mean, yeah, the base of the Republican Party wants to vote for Trump. The average American, literally the average American, does not want to vote for Trump.
How important, I guess, pulling back from politics, how important are politics to living in a good America?
So this is someplace where I'm very much on Team Gillespie.
You mean you, like me, you're moving to Canada?
No, just insofar as, like, I mean, I think a big part of the reason why you're a liberal, I don't think I've ever heard you say this, but it's always been my working assumption, a big part of the reason why you're a libertarian and a big part of the reason why I'm a conservative is I think that politics should only be about a small portion of our lives. Sure. Yeah. And one of the things that's making the country so fucked up is that partisan affiliation is now tracking more and more like a religious affiliation. It is more predictive of attitudes and behaviors than race, religion, or gender are, which is new in American history. And I think that, like, if people could just turn off cable news starting at, like, 7 o'clock, right? If people,
I take it your CNN hits are usually before 7.
Oh, no, mine are mostly in the evening, okay. But I truly don't care. Yeah. I mean, they've been very nice to me at CNN. Yeah. I hope they don't fire me, but, like, the days of me getting a lot of psychic reward about being on TV are past. You know, I'm just too fat and too old and too married to care. But if you are going to outsource your agency and your happiness to what is going on in Washington on a daily basis, unless you have, like, some specific, you know, if you need the FDA to do something so you can get a drug to save your life, I get why politics goes like that. But, like, barring those kinds of things, almost all the important things in our lives are things that happen at home.
Yeah. Why do you think then, you know, part of it might be that traditional religion, you know, has pulled back, so there's some space left for that. But why are people more invested in politics, it seems, or using that as a primary identity when in so many parts of our lives, it seems like we are actually able to choose more, you know, where we live, where we work, how we present, who we hang out with, what we consume, you know, both culturally as well as just in terms of other goods and services. Why has politics kind of emerged as the place where we spend a lot of time figuring out, you know, that this is very important to us?
Yeah. So part of my answer in my book was that it's that we increasingly follow politics like it's a form of entertainment. And when you follow entertainment that you're really invested in, a lot of your, like, bourgeois normal morality goes out the window. Like, you know, you don't care how many people the hero kills or punches in the face
So it's kind of like The Sopranos gives us Donald Trump.
A little bit. A little bit, yeah. So my point is that you just want the hero to get the MacGuffin at the end of the thing, right? And the problem is that when you follow politics as a form of entertainment, you're also, or when you get everything through screens, it's very easy to turn people you don't know into abstractions. And basically, all forms of political evil revolve to one extent or another by abstracting human beings, by turning them into avatars of a class rather than as individuals with moral dignity and agency. And so much of our politics now is, you know, sort of a violation of Dunbar's number. Like Dunbar's number says that you can only know for real as a human being like 150 people. And we now want to like think that, you know, we get very angry about people living the wrong way 2,000 miles away, that people we're never going to meet, people we're never going to talk to, but we see it on Twitter and it makes us angry. And Megan McArdle, our friend, you know, she makes the argument that part of the problem with Twitter and social media generally is it makes America like a really small town, a really nasty small town where everybody's in your business. And so I honestly think, you know, turning off a lot of that stuff and just caring a little less about politics, or caring a lot more about politics, but taking it freaking seriously, right? I mean, they pick, choose a lane. Don't know nothing about politics, but take it really freaking seriously. And I can't tell you how many people I meet who like don't know, you know, like the difference between the Senate and the House, but tell me like, you know, the Democrats are one vote away from destroying America and eating our livers. And I was like, you just don't know what you're talking about, but they take it really passionately. So like, I would rather people be a little more detached from politics and do a little more homework, or just tune it out entirely.
All right, let's open it up for some questions. Yeah, wouldn't it be the case that if politics was smaller, if the government regulated less of our lives, politics would kind of fall into its proper place?
I generally subscribe to that point of view. I have all of my life. I'm more skeptical of it than I used to be, because it turns out that there are enormous number. One of the reasons why politics is in a lot of people's lives is because a lot of people want politics in their want the government in their lives. And I think they're wrong, right? I think they're profoundly wrong. But, you know, the fact that campaigning on Medicare and Medicaid is a guaranteed route to getting more votes than losing tells you something about the expectations people have of government. I personally think that the way you would get politics to take up less of people's lives, well, there are two ways. One is send as much power down the most local level possible. Because that way, you'll still have culture war fights, you'll still have messy disagreements, you'll still have government getting involved in too much shit. But you'll also know the names of the people doing it, right? The powers that be will be Bob and Sarah and Phil, and you can yell at them.
That's right? Phil.
I hate that guy.
Can I interrupt, though, and ask, you know, is that what's happening with abortion? Because this is, you know, I think in an unpredicted way, you know, abortion went from being kind of settled at the remote level to now it is playing out in more or less in 50 states or a lot more. Yeah. And has that, you know, has that reduced politics or has that increased politics in everyday life?
I think it's sent. So the second part of my answer was going to be politics needs to happen where politics is supposed to happen, in legislatures, at the national and the local level. That is a sign of health. That's nature healing, right? And I think it's kind of too soon to tell. Mm-hmm. I do think that you are seeing one of the more interesting schisms on the right between the people who were actually pro-life and the people who said they were pro-life, but were really, there are three groups. One, just people who were full of shit and said whatever they can get away with, right? But then the principled people, you know, and this is a schism that runs through things like the Federalist Society, there are people who are sincerely pro-life. And then there were people who were sincerely constitutionalists. And you didn't have to choose between the two positions because they supported each other. You could hate Roe because of what it did for abortion, but you could also hate Roe because of what it did to the Constitution. And now you're finding people having to sort of, they have no muscle memory about how to defend the life issue. And they're really bad on the constitutional stuff. And so, like, it's funny. It's now you're starting to see Republicans basically make mirror image liberal arguments or progressive arguments about national bans and all that. And it's like, wait a second, I thought like until 5 minutes ago, we were saying for 50 years, let the states figure this out. And now that it's not going your way, you want to do what you condemned the left for wanting to do.
Another question. Yes. Has the right has splintered? Has the left also splintered? Or does it remain more kind of centralized around contempt for the American bourgeoisie?
Yeah. So I think the left is a really hot mess. I think that they
appear- is that a call out to AOC? I hear you conservatives are obsessed with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I am not obsessed with her. I think she is wrong about many things, but I see her, people like her and Ted Cruz as very similar. They are very good at exploiting negative polarization. The more you get attacked by the people your side hates, the more popular you are on your side. And they're both very good at it, and it's very cynical. I think that the serious left has a huge structural crisis on its hands that is masked by the fact that they still have sufficient control of various, what Lenin would call the commanding heights of the culture, right? But and they pull the strings of the Democratic Party to a weird extent. It's like the base of the Democratic Party isn't the mirror image of the Republican base. The Republican base are like lots of real human beings who have like blue collar jobs and or own car dealerships and that kind of thing. They're like normal Americans to one extent or another. The base of the Democratic Party is very much in a blue state bubble, blue city bubble, academic bubble, that kind of thing. And you can see, I mean, one of my heuristics for understanding American politics is to assume that both parties are determined to be minority parties, because it explains so much of their behavior. I don't care. I know, like, I'm culturally not as libertarian as some of the people probably in this room or on this stage, but like, as a matter of pure politics, forget the underlying substance of the issue. To try to persuade voters that they should stop saying mother and start saying birthing person is the birthing person of all asininities. It is so unbelievably stupid, right? I mean, like, there is a well-established finding in the social science literature that says a lot of people have a positive connotation of mothers.
Yeah, what's it going to do to tattoos, right?
Yeah. And this idea that you are going, and among the biggest constituencies that like mothers are people called mothers. And the idea that you are going to, like, try to gaslight them into saying they're bigots if they don't stop using the word mother or don't start using Latinx or however you were supposed to pronounce it, right? Like, all of the social science data, all the polling on this is that most Hispanics are infuriated when you try to use Latinx on them.
But is that the core left, right?
No,
or, I mean, what I'm saying is, like, is Biden part of that? Or?
No, so one point is that the ideological base of the Democratic Party are the people I'm basically talking about.
Okay.
The electoral base of the Democratic Party are like 58-year-old black ladies in South Carolina, and they are way to the right of all of these jackasses saying birthing person and all the rest of that kind of stuff. And that's why Biden got elected, right? That's why he got the nomination, is like the base of the Democratic Party are black working class middle-aged folks, especially women. And the thing that explains so much of the change in our politics, at least on the Democratic side, is that when we were growing up, when you talked about the black coalition in the Democratic Party, it was the Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition. It was the left wing of the Democratic Party. The thing that is keeping the Democratic Party from losing its frickin' mind are now black voters, because they are to the right of all of these, like, MSNBC producers and Slack channel Jacobins at the New York Times. And that's a really difficult thing for a lot of people in the bubble to sort of comprehend.
So do you, I mean, is the left going through a similar splintering, you know, in its kind of journalistic or commentariat institutions as well?
It feels like it to me. I think one of the things that explains a lot of the weirdness of our time is this sort of dumb version of postmodernism that says words are magic. And if you can just change the way we describe reality, it'll change reality. And I think it exists on the right, but it's like seeped into the groundwater on the left. And I have a certain amount of sympathy and nostalgia for Bernie Sanders type stuff. I think the left made a huge mistake when it decided to go race over class and how it talks about the sort of central, what is the testing point of their political priorities? I mean, again, I don't like the class stuff either.
There was that specific moment, I guess, in 2016, right, where he was literally kind of pushed off the stage by a couple of black women who were asserting identity politics over his class-based stuff. And he kind of reemerged talking much more about identity.
I mean, one of the great ironies is that the best critics of the 1619 Project were those guys from like the IWW, you know, the International World Socialist website or whatever that thing is called, who were like, no, we are not going to completely ditch Marxian analysis for this intersectional racial stuff. And I wish that fight were more in the open. But I think the thing that keeps it from that those fights from spilling out in the open is the just profound left, the white left's guilt, sort of racial guilt. It's sort of like, remember that episode of Seinfeld where George Costanza?
The answer is yes.
Has this crush on this woman who hates him.
Right.
And he's just like, oh.
He finds that very attractive.
Your contempt for me, it's just so exquisite. I can't look away, right? That's sort of how a lot of white liberals look at the they allow themselves to be manipulated by being called racist. And there's such cheap dates on that stuff. And until that sort of works itself out a little bit, I think they're going to paper over a lot of their internal divisions.
Another question. Jerry? So the question is first, and I'll
skip the compliments.
Truncate it a little bit, Jenna. Why are you such an asshole? That was the question. Where do libertarians fit into this integralist worldview, or how do they relate to that? And also, given the way that you've been talking about, you know, respect for liberal kind of frameworks and things like that, why aren't you a libertarian yet?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you know, I've become more libertarian over the years. First of all, I think I'm with Friedrich Hayek. I'm what has two thumbs and loves Friedrich Hayek, this guy. and Hayek hated the term libertarian too. It's not euphonious. He called himself an old Whig, which was a call out to Edmund Burke, who was also an old Whig.
I think he might have been a cross-dresser, to be quite honest.
And there's an H in there.
No, it's a German-Austrian tradition.
And part of my problem with libertarianism is that a lot of what passes for libertarianism is really cultural libertinism in the U.S. And I'm not saying about that this room.
Can you say what do you mean by that? Is it that anything goes, or anything that's peaceful among consenting adults goes? Is that libertinism, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a cultural project. The looking askance at making, let me put it this way. A lot of things I dislike about left liberalism is this whole anti-judgmentalism. And I think there's a lot of anti-judgmentalism among libertarians as well.
You have not hung out with many libertarians.
And
I think that they're not, they are the judgiest people.
Oh, no. I don't mean like in terms of catty gossip stuff. I mean in terms of like, what political arguments that they're willing to make and not make, and that kind of thing, even when they're for libertarianism's own good. Part of it is, I guess, I am also, most of the consistent libertarians I know, and I know many, they're more troubled by statism at the local level than I am, and I'm really not. I think that you have to have the right to exit, and you have to protect the basic fundamental civil rights, you know, like, slavery is a settled issue. Jim Crow's a settled issue. I don't want to revisit that. Part of the thing that's so dismaying to me about what's going on the right is so many assholes think that there are no settled questions on the right. I mean, this Pedro Gonzalez guy, right? I don't know if you follow it. He's
an editor at Chronicles magazine, and it's just come out that he has had a long history of overtly racist and anti-Semitic.
Right.
Messaging.
And it's all kind of delicious for people like me, because basically, because he's pro DeSantis, it's all his old friends who are in the same chats and text threads who didn't mind any of the anti-Semitism and racism when they were all on Team Trump. They're now ratting him out because he's a DeSantis guy. And so like Breitbart, which aired this thing clearly as a help to Trump, they show no journalistic curiosity whatsoever about who were the other people in these chat rooms where this guy Pedro Gonzalez is talking about, you know, what are we going to do about the Jewish question? And the reason I bring up the Jewish question is like the second you ask, what is your position on the Jewish question? You are presupposing like the state has any right to an answer to whatever you fucking think the Jewish question is. It's like, what are we going to do about left-handed people? Fucking nothing, because it's none of the state's business. It's like, you know, like, and like the whole idea that once we're in power, we're going to have an answer to the Jewish question is terrifyingly gross to me. And so there are a lot of these questions. There's a lot of the stuff that people like the validity of the Constitution, the validity of free markets, that these opportunists that we're talking about earlier think are, well, I'm just asking questions, right? You know, they're just, they think it's perfectly fine to raise. To get back to your point, well, your question, as long as you have the right to exit, I think there is nothing wrong with really conservative local communities. That, you know, as Nick has put it, you know, a utopia of utopias, right? Although as a conservative, I don't believe in utopias, and neither did Thomas More, the guy who created the term. But I think you can have a lot of different definitions of a good society. You know, I always tell, when I talk to college kids about this, I say, part of my vision of conservatism is I want to make this a more interesting country to drive across. And that means you're going to have weird stuff in Austin that's weird, that's going to, like, you know, shock the bourgeoisie. But then you're going to have bourgeoisie places that are going to shock the hipsters. And I think that there is something still sort of culturally in libertarianism and in liberalism that still kind of struggles with some of those.
So it's a little bit, I mean, it was implicit and maybe explicit in parts of liberal fascism, your book. I mean, liberalism is kind of overwhelming. It really starts to seep into every aspect of human society. I will just say, as somebody who lived full and part-time in a very small town, that really made me dislike government, you know, kind of oppressive government at a local level.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, I have no problem with people who don't like it.
You know, this is a long time project I'm trying to sell. I'm putting him in a libertarian car. You know, at some point, I think libertarianism will do more to make this country interesting in the way that you described it, to drive across.
As you know, a policy matter, I mean, where I get off the train from the libertarians, it's not a lot of things. Yeah. Like I'm much more skeptical about the mass legalization of weed in this country. Yeah. I would have rather to have a couple states test it out for a decade and see how it goes, rather than just everybody jump into it.
That's kind of happening. Yeah. I mean, well, Liz, you had a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to get us away from the Jewish question.
There are only Jewish questions.
We're in New York, so the Jewish questions are
Yeah, the question is, what does the, you know, the different outcomes for J.D. Vance, who won a Senate seat in Ohio, and Blake Masters, who lost the Senate seat in Arizona, tell us about the power of NatCon ideology, or what might we be looking at that we're missing if we just focus on NatCons?
Yeah, so, you know, I got two different hats. I got a lot of different hats, but the two different hats that are relevant here is, one is the pundit hat. What happened, you know, in the election politics kind of stuff. And the other one is sort of my concern about the conservative movement, about the intellectual side of things and all that kind of stuff. On the intellectual side, I take a lot of this NatCon and post-liberal stuff really, really seriously. You know, my friend George Will, he says, look, the lesson of the 20th century is that small committed groups of ideologues change the world, for good or for ill, but, you know, Bolsheviks, conservatives, whoever, right? Like, you can have real power by taking institutions. And so I think taking these ideas really seriously and trying to, like, keep the right from losing its mind is a really important project. Putting on my political hat, I think you're exactly right. The whole thing was a fizzle. Like J.D. Vance, he basically ran in a state that went +8 for Trump. And he ran basically on a mix of, I love Trump's Musk, and I have Sherrod Brown's policies. I was like, well, congrats, right? Meanwhile, everybody else who was a Trumpy, and it's not just Blake Masters, you know, Carrie Lake, you can go around, they all lost. All the people who embraced the bullshittery, the election denial stuff, they all lost. It is, and this gets to the thing I was trying to say before about how there is this, you know, I recently wrote that part of the problem the right has these days is that an irony of ironies is, for all the talk about critical race theory, they've imbibed what you could call critical Trump theory, right? The critical race theory stuff, which has real merit and real arguments to it, I'm not trying to diminish it, but like the cartoon version of it, or the elevator pitch version of critical race theory, is that our institutions are so suffused with racism, the legacy of historical racism is so deep, that black men in particular just can't get justice in this country. So you shouldn't even put them in jail. You shouldn't try them with crimes. You should defund the police, you know, all these kinds of things because the institutions are unsavable and we just should walk away. Obviously, I disagree with that argument, but like there was like this thing called slavery and Jim Crow, and there is real historical, you know, racism that you can have to contend with. Critical Trump theory takes the same, the anatomy as the exact same logic, which is by definition, if Trump comes out a loser in any process, it is proof that the process is corrupt, right? He lost an election. That's proof that the system is rigged. He's indicted. It's proof that they all hate Trump, right? When Bill Barr tells him right before he resigns in the Oval Office, we've looked into all this stuff. It's bullshit. It's not real. Trump's response isn't, oh yeah, well, what about the ballot stuff and whatever? He says, you must hate Trump, right? It is this idea that you can reduce big, serious things to this really niche form of bigotry, which is like hating this, you know, Cheeto Jesus from Queens defines the entire warp and woof of our system, right? And it's a loser politically. And you'll always hear from these people, they talk about it as like, yeah, no, but if we really turn out the base, it's like everything that you can do to turn out our base or their base will turn off more voters than it attracts, right? And the arguments you always get from them is like the salesman who says, sure, we lose money on every sale, but we'll make up for it in volume, right? I mean, it's really bad politics. Meanwhile, Mike DeWine, who was the governor of Ohio, Vance wins by like a 6, you know, DeWine won by 30. The normies are more popular. But they're not willing to fight for themselves. They're not willing to stick their heads up because they know if they do, they'll get attacked by Trump.
Yes. Final question, sir. So the final question is, how does this resolve, particularly on the right? A lot of the leadership is old. They're going to die. What happens next? Is it more like Mike DeWine types, or is it people who are further on the edges or fringes of things?
I think it's like a fever. It's going to have to run its course for a little while longer. Partly it just has to do with the nature of the media that supports a lot of this, the sort of bullshittery kind of stuff. And I'm still fairly long-term bullish on America. But I think that what we're going to, you know, sometimes you have to show people, you can't just tell them, right? People have to learn from their mistakes and respond to them. And, you know, when Ed Koch ran for a third term here in New York when I was a kid, you know, he lost, he was asked, are you ever going to run again? And he says, no, the people of New York fired me and now they must be punished, right? So like, you have to learn from, as Edmund Burke says, example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other. Sometimes you have to go through the mistakes to learn, to realize that they were mistakes. We've been doing that for a little while now. And I think it's kind of due for a grown-up. I think that one of the things you really need is the right, I hate this, but you need the right personality. I mean, you need the right charismatic personality of somebody who, I mean, let's face it, there were a lot of people who insisted. Just look at what happened in the 2012 primaries. You know, they made Mitt Romney bend, you know, to fit, you know, the Reagan mold. When he, you know, I used to say that the GOP primaries were like a C-SPAN remake of Spartacus. You know, where everyone was, I am Ronald Reagan. No, I am Ronald Reagan, right? And then 4 years later, the entire base of the Republican Party was like, yeah, we don't really care about any of that stuff. And it was all because you had a personality come along that bent people to it. And I hate having American political life depend upon charismatic personalities. But if you could have someone who had sort of that power for good, I think it would hasten improvement pretty quickly. But moreover, you know, the thing I always tell people, and this is something that I think applies every bit as much to libertarians as it does to conservatives of my stripe, is have some fucking confidence in your positions. You know, if you actually believe that markets work better than statism, if you actually believe that, you know, the rights of the individual will prove to be more important than the rights of the collective, and whatever phraseology you want to put on this stuff, have some confidence that this country will, that you'll be proven right over time, right? If you believe free trade is better than protectionism, it's going to show up in the data, right? And it's going to give you facts and evidence to persuade voters with. And it may take longer than I would like. It may be frustrating. It may be more mixed than I would like and all that kind of stuff, but it'll happen. But this idea of like what Marco Rubio is doing is just throwing, remember he got elected as the face of the Tea Parties. And now he's taking the side of unions and the Arbeitsfrei movement or whatever it is. And all because he's trying to chase voters rather than persuade voters. And a little more courage from politicians to actually stand up on some principles and make an argument, persuade people, would help. But this, just to close it out, this gets back to like where I began. This country has a culture. These people, you know, Americans believe in some shit. They may not be able to articulate it in a way that like political scientists find pithy or anything like that. But this is a good and decent country. People don't like getting bossed around by the government, even if they want free stuff from the government more than they should. My favorite example of this, and I'll just close on this, is Seymour Martin Lipset, who was one of my hero intellectuals. He was a political scientist and a sociologist. He used to say the greatest natural experiment in the history of political science wasn't like West Germany versus East Germany or North Korea versus South Korea. It was Canada versus America, United States. Because you had the same basic genetic populations, the same political institutions, the same language for the most part, not counting the frogs. But what defined these two populations was that at the time of the American Revolution, if you were a loyalist or a royalist, you either stayed in Canada or you moved there. And if you were on the side of, you know, letting your freak flag fly for freedom, you either stayed in the 13 colonies or you moved there. Fast forward 200 years, and this is Marty's point, not mine, he would point out that the United States and Canada at the basically the exact same time switched to the metric system. And the Canadians said, okay, and just switched, right? It was like, I got nothing to complain about, right? And just did it, right? And the Americans are like, this is witchcraft. I will have nothing to do with this. And they just refused to take an order from the government. That's American, right? And there were Democrats and liberals who refused to do it. And there were Republicans and conservatives. And there were like the unwashed normals refused to do it. It's just like, that's America. And that's why the stuff from like the nationalists and the integralists and the stuff, it rests on this assumption. It's this power worship fantasy that, I know that my troops lie just beyond the Alps, and all I need to do is activate them, and everyone will be on my side. And they don't actually have to make an argument. And that's why their arguments won't sell to anybody who doesn't already believe in them. Democracy is about disagreement, not about agreement. It's about making arguments and selling people on stuff. And the moment we can start moving away from performative jackassery towards making arguments again is the moment where we start to heal.
All right, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank Jonah Goldberg for talking with Reason. Let's continue the night. Thank you all. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe, get it automatically delivered to your inbox. We're putting out 2 episodes a week, and you don't want to miss a single one. Or you can make it super easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. And while you're at reason.com/podcasts, check out the Reason Roundtable and the SoHo Forum Debates, our 2 other regular podcast series. Thanks for listening.